On this edition for Sunday, February 17th, ISIS spreads its footprint to West Africa. Venezuela's humanitarian crisis deepens as aid sits across the border in Colombia. And an Oscar-nominated film with an up-close look at end-of-life choices. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Hari Srinivasan.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. 2 days after President Trump declared a national emergency in order to spend billions of dollars in additional funding for a wall or barrier along the U.S.-Mexico border, he's facing both political and legal challenges. Representative Adam Schiff called the president's declaration, quote, plainly unconstitutional.
Is this the first time a president has tried to declare an emergency when Congress explicitly rejected funding for the particular project that the president is advocating? And in saying just the other day that he didn't really need to do this, he just wanted to do it because it would help things go faster, he's pretty much daring the court to strike this down. So it's hard to imagine a poor case, but I'll say this, Dana, it is going to be a real test for my GOP colleagues in Congress and their devotion to the institution.
White House senior advisor Stephen Miller said the president will defend his emergency declaration even if Congress votes to stop him.
If they pass a resolution of disapproval, will the president veto that, which would be the first veto of his presidency?
Well, obviously, the president is going to protect his national emergency declaration, Chris. And I know that we're out of time, but again, I want to make this point. There's no threat.
So, yes, he will veto?
He's going to protect his national emergency declaration, guaranteed.
On the legal front, California's Attorney General Javier Becerra told ABC News that more states, including New Mexico, Oregon, Hawaii, and Minnesota, are joining the planned lawsuit challenging the national emergency declaration. Heather Nauert, President Trump's choice to be U.N. ambassador, withdrew from consideration late yesterday. In a State Department release, Nauert said her decision was based on what was best for her family, saying, quote, the past 2 months have been grueling. Several news organizations also reported that Nauert's family had employed a nanny from a foreign country who was legally in the U.S., but who did not have legal work status. The administration never officially nominated Nauert, but last December, after former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley resigned, Mr. Trump called Nauert, quote, very talented, very smart, very quick. Nauert was a spokeswoman for the State Department and previously a reporter at Fox News. U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in Syria reported today that the Islamic State is keeping more than 1,000 civilians from leaving the militants' final enclave in eastern Syria. The Kurdish-Syrian Democratic Forces say ISIS fighters are hiding among the civilians and using caves and tunnels in a one-square-mile area of the village of Baghouz. The Kurds also say they are holding 1,000 captured ISIS fighters, most from foreign countries. The Kurds claim victory over ISIS is imminent, and in tweets last night, President Trump again declared victory and asked European countries to take captured ISIS fighters from their countries and put them on trial, saying, quote, time for others to step up and do the job that they are so capable of doing. We are pulling back after 100% caliphate victory. The streets in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, were quieter today after 9 days of violent protests. Last night, the prime minister announced emergency cuts in government spending and promised to investigate charges of corruption and embezzlement by government officials. Protesters are demanding the resignation of Haiti's president Jovenel Moïse, holding him accountable for skyrocketing inflation and government corruption. The United States and Canada have issued do-not-travel warnings, and some tourists and medical workers have been unable to leave Haiti. The U.S. military continued to deliver humanitarian aid to the Venezuela-Colombia border today against the wishes of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. U.S. Senator Marco Rubio arrived at the border this morning to tour the aid facilities and meet with members of Venezuela's National Assembly. Juan Guaido, who also claims the presidency, said yesterday that volunteers will escort the aid through barricades on an unused bridge between the two nations on February 23rd. For more on the fight against Islamic State militants in Syria, visit pbs.org/newshour. Tomorrow, President Trump plans to give a speech in Florida, largely focused on Venezuela and the U.S. backing for its self-proclaimed President Juan Guaido. But President Maduro is not showing signs of leaving and seems to continue to have the support of the military. So how did this situation happen? What's the United States' role in Venezuela? And is there a connection between Venezuela policy and increasing opposition to the government in Haiti? For some perspective and analysis, we turn to Christopher Sabatini, an adjunct professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and editor of Global Americans, a newsletter focused on Latin America and the Caribbean. Now, we've had lots of conversations on this program about the kind of immediate crisis that Venezuela is going through, the lack of medicine and food on the shelves, right? The things that the people are suffering through. But in the bigger picture, how do we get here?
A large part of it is actually politics. So what's happened over the last 20 years, and it's been 20 years that this government has been in power, first under Hugo Chavez and then Nicolas Maduro, they've slowly closed off all the avenues for political participation and political mediation. They packed the Supreme Court, they packed the Electoral Council, they've actually sort of banned opposition parties from running. And so what effectively happened was there was no real way for the opposition to, in an incredibly crisis-driven situation in which the popularity of the government has fallen, there's no way for the opposition to gain any traction. And so at one moment, the National Assembly, which is effectively the last democratically elected institution in the country, appointed its president, Juan Guaido, and then declared under the Constitution that the current de facto president, Nicolas Maduro, was illegitimate because he had won in a largely discredited election in May 2018. Mm-hmm. And therefore, under the Constitution, Juan Guaido is the president. So now you have the situation where you have two presidents. And effectively what happened was that provided a moment within the political system in Venezuela that allowed the international community to rally in defense of democracy and human rights and recognize Juan Guaido. And in the lead in all this largely has been the U.S. Mm-hmm. President Trump has called Juan Guaido twice. Vice President Pence has met with his delegate to the Washington, D.C. as ambassador. So the U.S. is really taking the lead, although it's important to recognize there are 60 other countries that are also backing Juan Guaido.
You know, what are our vested interests in backing Guaido? I mean, there's obviously the humanitarian concern, but strategically, how important is Venezuela to the United States?
Well, first of all, normatively, it's important because within the hemisphere, there is a thing called the Inter-American Democratic Charter, in which all the signatories, all 34 states of the hemisphere, have agreed to protect and defend representative democracy and the checks and balances of democracy. And for the last 20 years, the Venezuelan government, the Chavista government, has thumbed its nose at this sort of normative structure. So first of all, there's that issue that it's out of step with the rest of the hemisphere. Second of all, there is really a strategic element to this. More than 3.3 million people, Venezuelans, have left Venezuela and are fleeing and taking with them oftentimes insecurity, poverty. They're really a drain on a lot of countries, although they're accepting them. And then last is the issue of China and Russia. What was a democracy and human rights issue confined mostly to Venezuela has now become a geopolitical issue because as the other 60 countries have lined up to support Guaido, other countries from, let's say, the other side have lined up to in defense of Nicolas Maduro. So you have Syria, Iran, Russia, China, and Turkey now mm-hmm. backing Maduro. So this has really boiled down to a geostrategic issue that goes to the U.S. interests within the hemisphere, not just around human rights, but also sort of its own national interest.
So what happens in the next few days? I mean, the United States has been sending shipments of humanitarian aid that is sitting across the border in Colombia. Guaido says, we are going to figure out a way to get this in. Maduro technically doesn't have to let convoys of stuff come here, and he's got a military that can stop it.
Hari, no one really knows. I mean, added to this is the fact that Donald Trump has said numerous times, and a number of people within his cabinet have said that the military option is still on the table. So you have that hovering in the context of more than 30 interventions that have from the United States have ended, many of them ended badly within the hemisphere. So you have the shadow of the U.S. legacy of the bad Uncle Sam intervention. Right now, you have the assistance on the Colombian-Venezuela border. U.S. Marines actually protecting it that have helped deliver it. It is basically a showdown right now, and we'll have to see who blinks first.
And finally, you know, yesterday we had a conversation on the program about Haiti, and there's this sort of connection here between Venezuelan money and influence and what's happening in Haiti's political turmoil.
Yeah, so Venezuela built a coalition within the hemisphere, in large part to sort of thwart any sort of challenges to its legitimacy and its efforts to violate human rights by this basically an oil giveaway program called Petrocaribe. And there are a number of beneficiaries, and one of them was the Haitian government. Well, first of all, about a year ago, a report came out alleging that most of the money that came from that oil program has disappeared. including ties to the former president and ties to the current cabinet members. So this has ignited a series of protests for this clear example of malfeasance and corruption. But there's also some allegations that somehow Venezuela may be behind it in other ways, because Haiti has flipped, and it's one of those countries that is now recognizing Guaido and not recognizing Maduro. So there's also this element of who's behind these protests that have rocked Haiti now for over a week and have resulted in the deaths of, at last count, 7 people.
So their allegiance is going back and forth to two parties that are struggling inside Venezuela right now.
Exactly. And it plays out, the ripple effects of what could have been only a domestic issue are streaming across the region and across the world.
All right, Christopher Sabatini from Columbia University, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Harry.
ISIS-controlled territory is shrinking in Syria, and the U.S. president is declaring a military victory over the terrorist group. But there is another front growing in West Africa. A group known as ISWAP, the Islamic State West Africa Province, is expanding its territory in northeast Nigeria and surrounding countries. I spoke with Drew Hinshaw, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who's been covering the rise of this new group. He joined us from Warsaw, Poland, last weekend via Skype. Let's talk about the growth of ISIS in West Africa, or they call themselves ISWAP. Who are they?
Yeah, thanks for having me. ISWAP is a faction of Boko Haram, or was a faction of Boko Haram that split for a bunch of reasons, one of which is they felt that Boko Haram was just far too brutal on the civilian population, torching villages, all the kind of things you would read about a few years ago, sending young children as suicide bombers. They had tactical advice from ISIS. Even ISIS thought that Boko Haram was too brutal, too the uncivilian friendly, and that's coming from ISIS. And so ISIS basically sent a series of letters to the Nigerian group that wanted to break away from Boko Haram and kind of laid out a theology that would be much more civilian friendly, the kind of things that guerrilla groups all around the world have tried to do, befriend the local population, mesh yourself with the village, make it safe for people to come back to their farms and trade. I don't want to paint a totally, you know, picture of this ISIS group as if they're civilian friendly, because they've also, you know, committed their own massacres. But they're, compared to Boko Haram, they've been just much more better at the game of winning civilian support and creating a local population that doesn't mind them.
And your reporting points out that they are gaining territory and they're actually making strategic wins and defeating standing military bases.
That's right. They've been, I think they've overrun 14. Last time we did a count or saw a count, it was 14 military bases in northeastern Nigeria. And some of those are, you know, little more than a bit of fence and some, you know, kind of small houses. But some of those are proper military bases. There was one on the shores of Lake Chad where you had German donated patrol boats. Troops would come there from Chad, Niger, Cameroon. It was a major center. And they spied on it using handheld drones, and then they overran it and took away, you know, enormous amounts of weapons and supplies they reportedly gave back to the local population.
So if you look at a map and see that they're kind of across now, Nigeria, Niger, Chad, what's their goal here? Do they want to build the equivalent of another caliphate in Africa?
Yeah, I think there's something like that. You know, when something that people miss is when ISIS declared their caliphate, they didn't consider their caliphate only Iraq and Syria. They kind of had these sort of, in a way, very grandiose declaration that, you know, there was a province in West Africa and a province here and a province in Libya. And the West Africa province, as they call it, has gone pretty far. I think they've learned from some of ISIS's strategic errors. They haven't baited the West. If anything, they've benefited from the U.S.'s sort of shift away from counterterrorism as the big U.S. Military priority. I think that you could say they're creating something like a territory where the Nigerian government, frankly, can't dislodge them and see some benefit of a kind of live and let live relationship.
So I was going to ask, what is the U.S. role here? I mean, have we essentially retreated, considered that the Boko Haram fight is over, and are we paying attention to this?
Well, I think there's definitely a shift, and you know, the Pentagon will talk about it, a shift away from counterterrorism as our overriding priority to contesting great powers like China. And that means that you've seen a lot of drawbacks in support for, you know, counterterrorism missions in West Africa and elsewhere. I think we've cut troop levels by 10% in West Africa, if I've got that number right, which is, you know, it's not huge. But, you know, when the U.S. does that, the Nigerians see that as well and say, well, if it's not a priority for the Americans, frankly, this is a part of our country that's not economically productive. where we've had a stalemate for years and years and years. And I think it sends a signal, you know, rightly or wrongly, that the Nigerians themselves have deprioritized or can deprioritize this as a concern, because the country has other challenges.
All right, Drew Hinshaw of The Wall Street Journal joining us via Skype from Poland tonight. Thanks so much.
Thank you, too.
Directors Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman are no strangers to Oscar nods, winning Oscars 3 decades ago for the documentary films The Times of Harvey Milk in 1985 and Common Threads in 1990, films widely known for positively influencing LGBT history. Their Netflix short film is an upfront and compassionate look at palliative care and hospice through terminally ill patients, their families, and the medical practitioners who guide them through their end-of-life choices. It's called Endgame, and it's nominated for an Academy Award. Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman recently stopped by the studio.
Dying is one of the two things that we all share in common. We're born and mm-hmm. we die. And it's the one thing we just, you know, we push away the unimaginable. It's the ultimate existential dilemma, right? We're, you know, we're here and then we're not here. So we do whatever we can to avoid thinking about it, talking about it, imagining it for ourselves. So here, you know, we found these practitioners whose job it is, day in and day out, to help us with that, to help us through whatever suffering there might be involved in that experience for ourselves and our loved ones.
Give me a sense of scale here. You chose two programs that are happening in San Francisco, a relatively progressive city in modern day America, right? What is the traditional form that most people end up dying in America today versus these options that seem pretty new and foreign to a lot of people that might be watching your documentary?
Well, I mean, what we wanted to present is the continuum of options mm-hmm. from being in a hospital and what a hospital is designed to do if you're there at that point in your life, which is all about treatment and trying to keep you alive, regardless of the circumstances. The other end of the continuum is hospice, where you're really there for that end-of-life experience and the quality of care that you're given in that situation. So what we do in the film is to present that continuum of choice.
There's also a challenge that people have with physically letting go of the body, right? There's all kinds of philosophical questions here. Is this the end? Is there a spirit? Is there a soul? What happens after I die? If I'm an organ donor, what's going to happen to my body or my daughter's body, right? There's a struggle here for on so many different levels that you witness that the families are going through.
Yeah, and they're difficult problems. They could be the most difficult problems we'll ever face. And what really inspired us was watching these practitioners whose job it is really to help us work through these dilemmas and figure out what options we want that would align with what we believe in. And that's different for each person.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, because these practitioners are working, their job is within the context of terminal illness, all these issues come into play, psychological, emotional, sociological, all those issues around end of life come into play in their work.
How much of the challenge here is about the patient themselves versus all the people around the patient that have their own issues about the psychological, the sociological, et cetera, right? I mean, it seems that sometimes it's harder for everyone else around the sick person to let go.
Well, it's one system, and it's one reason that the conversation is so important, that the people who are around you when you're facing the end understand and respect your wishes. But that can only happen if there's discussion about it.
Palliative care is a whole team. So there's a physician, there's a social worker, there's a chaplain, there's an intern, and all of the team of palliative care workers work with the family as well as the patient. So mm-hmm. all of that is part of the conversation that's going on with the whole team.
And you also point out that different traditions deal with this differently. that it's, you know, there's kind of the mainstream American, you know, putting people into a casket and burying them, but in between there's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, letting go is a big part of the process. And, you know, it's one of the aspects of the film that I think made it bearable was that there's so much caring and love involved in both caring for patients and also letting go of loved ones. As painful as it is, the pain is something that comes from love and feeling the love from families and also feeling the deep empathy and caring from the caregivers in these institutions that we were filming in was really, in the end, very inspiring.
One of the doctors in the film says, dying is not a medical issue, it's a human issue. And that's something that we all share, that we all have in common. At the end, what we hope for is that it's about human kindness and compassion and patience and love. I mean, that's what we all hope for.
Well, what did it do to you now that you've finished the film? Did you rethink? Do you have a list of wishes? Did you guys clarify this? I mean,
I definitely wrote an advance directive. You know, I made sure that everyone around me knows what I want and what I don't want. But I think at a deeper level, it really made me, it gave me more of a relationship with death, which as something that's a part of life, not as something scary to be run away from, but just something to look at with open eyes.
The Oscar nod, are you expecting that?
I mean, we weren't thinking about the Oscars until the nominations were announced.
Right.
But now that's all we're thinking about.
Rob Epstein, Jeffrey Friedman, thank you both.
Thank you.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
We've just heard from co-directors Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman about their Oscar-nominated Netflix film Endgame and their approach to something every living person on this earth will inevitably have to face, death. It's an intimate look at end-of-life choices with terminally ill patients, their families, and medical personnel. Here's an excerpt from Endgame with patient Kim Anderson and how she's choosing to live the rest of her life.
Nice to meet you. I'm the doctor on the palliative care team, Steve Hamilton.
Have you heard of palliative care before?
Sure.
We have palliative care up at home.
Well, can I ask you what you understand palliative care to be?
Sort of end-of-life care.
Yeah, but we think of palliative care as helping people live as well as possible for as long as possible.
We work together. It's doctors and nurses and social workers and chaplains
focused on
not just the disease, but the whole person.
To really help people with their symptoms, making sure they have information they need to make good decisions about their care, support for the patient and family, emotional, psychological, spiritual support.
Mm-hmm. We're sort of in a spot where we're not really ready for hospice, I don't think, anyway, and I think she thinks the same thing.
When you say not ready, tell me what your thoughts are.
What are your thoughts?
Well, to me, I guess part of that is
like very, very end of life. Oh. Hospice has a label of, oh, that's it, kiss it, right. Goodbye. But this is more help you transition.
Totally.
I've been a nurse for 40 years. Patients come into the hospital and die, and that's not how I wanted to do it. So I wanted to stay home.
Tomorrow on NewsHour, how music can make a movie. Terrence Blanchard is up for an Oscar for scoring Spike Lee's Black Klansman. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.